So shall we do the third Dalai Lama's text?
This ground anointed with perfume, flowers soon about may rue, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a rural land and offered to
we finished the part about the four great qualities of the Lamrim. So it's nice to think about those, and it gives us some inspiration in studying the Lamrim, because we see the benefit. And hopefully in that fourth one too, about not criticizing other traditions. You know, that we'll learn there really to see the value of other people's spiritual practice, even if they have views that we might consider wrong views. We can still see that, you know, what they're doing is beneficial in the sense of teaching them to practice ethical discipline and kindness and so on. And as Holiness has said on many situations, that, you know, because Buddhas can manifest as anyone, so they can manifest as non-Buddhists. Yeah? And, you know, they can manifest as somebody from another religion, as that religion's teacher, teaching these people certain views, because that's according to the dispositions and tendencies and interests of those people, and it's a skillful way to lead them. And so when you see it that way, then it can really help us respect other religious traditions without feeling like, you know, we have to criticize them or their practitioners in order to feel that what we're doing is good. Okay, but instead we hold our own views because we see that, you know, that the Buddhist teachings, that, you know, that when you investigate them with reason and logic, they make sense. They help us in terms of our experience. But we don't have to criticize other people or other traditions. Yeah, so whether they're other Buddhist traditions or other religious traditions, the thing is to see what is beneficial in them. But then, like I said last time, in terms of the ideas and concepts, you can debate those, yeah, with a mind that wants to understand how things actually are, and, you know, what holds up through reasoning. But we don't debate in order to come out victorious, or in order to demolish somebody else's belief system just for the sake of demolishing it. That doesn't do anybody any good. Okay. So then I'll continue reading the text. The next part says, consider the beneficial effects of hearing or teaching the Dharma even once. An understanding of Buddha and his teachings arises, and by means of pure attitudes and application, the person who is a suitable vessel for Dharma collects benefits equivalent to those gained by having heard all the words of Buddha. Therefore, abandon the three wrong attitudes, likened to a dirty pot, a pot with a hole in the bottom, and an upturned pot, and generate the six recognitions. In this way, you will be able to gather the wealth of having approached the subject properly. Whether you are studying or teaching a Lamrim text, do so purely and with intensity. J. Rinpoche said, one session of hearing or teaching this tradition embodying the essence of all Buddha's words collects waves of merit equivalent to hearing or teaching all Buddha Dharma. Okay. So here the third Dalai Lama is talking about the benefits of listening to the Dharma and the benefits of teaching the Dharma. Okay, and so to really appreciate that and think of those benefits. And I think that's important, especially when we live in a Dharma community, because it can be very easy to take these things for granted. Oh, here's another teaching to go to. Or, oh, gotta go give another teaching. But, you know, instead of, you know, really thinking of the benefits of these, of listening or speaking the teachings, the imprint it has on your own mind, how you're sharing the Dharma, the long-term consequences of it. And therefore, when we either teach or listen, to do so with attention and with a very pure motivation and in a very correct way. Okay. So he said to abandon the three wrong attitudes, likened to a dirty pot, a pot with a hole in the bottom and an upturned pot. Okay, so a dirty pot, that's somebody who comes to teachings with the wrong motivation. Okay? So it's, they come to teachings with the motivation of, oh, okay, I'm going to learn some Buddhist stuff and then I'm going to be able to teach it. And then people will think I'm holy, they're going to think I'm spiritual, I might even be able to make a livelihood out of teaching the Dharma, because these people will give me offerings, and they'll give me respect, and they'll do stuff for me, okay? And so your mind, which is like a vessel ready to have the Dharma being poured into it, because of this wrong motivation, our mind becomes a dirty vessel, so that any Dharma we hear, our mind completely pollutes it by having the wrong motivation. So that's why it's so important before coming to teachings, and why we always start out, you know, at the beginning of a teaching session, thinking about our motivation and setting it. So even if you're in a situation where the teacher doesn't lead you through setting the motivation, you know, we should just be habituated enough and automatically do that ourselves. Yeah. And then the next kind of thing we want to avoid is being like a pot with the hole in the bottom. Okay, so that person comes to the teachings, but they can't retain anything. Yeah, it goes in one ear and out the other. Yeah, so they hear the teachings, and they nod because they understand, you know, when they're getting it. But then afterwards, they can't retain anything. So when they sit down to meditate, their mind's a total blank. Yeah. So that's why I think I found for myself, taking notes can be very helpful, mm-hmm. Yeah, to stop the mind that's like a sieve. Because not only do I have something to go back to, but also when I take notes, it makes me pay attention. Better because I have to write something down. But this is completely up to the individual. Sometimes you know the outline already very well and so don't take notes. Or sometimes you want to really spend your time listening and taking it in and having it as an experience. And the nice thing now is that because things are taped, you can go back and listen to them again. And then, you know, take notes the second or third time, something like that. But we do want to make sure that we have some retention of what was said. And then the third kind of pot is the upside down pot. So this is somebody who comes to teachings and it doesn't even go in, okay, because they're falling asleep or their mind's completely, totally distracted. You know, they're thinking about where they came from or where they want to go or they're worrying about something, and so the Dharma's not even going in at all. Their body is in the room and their mind is elsewhere. So we want to make sure that we listen with full attention and with the correct motivation, and that we review the teachings that we've heard later on. Yeah? And I think this can be very, very helpful. I've been doing it in some of the teachings I've been listening to here, is then in the morning, reviewing and contemplating the major points of the teaching that I listened to the previous evening. Yeah? And found that very, very effective, you know, because when you're listening to teaching, you can't necessarily take it all in. You know, you're getting a lot of information, but there's a lot there to really think about. And so reviewing it in the subsequent days. That was very good. And then he advised us to practice the six recognitions. Okay? So I'll just go through them and then come back and explain them. The first one is seeing ourselves as the patient. The second is the Buddha as the doctor. The third is the Dharma as the medicine. Four is the practice, practicing as the way to get cured. And five is seeing the Buddha as a holy being whose Dharma method is non-deceptive. And six is praying that the Dharma exists long. Okay, so we want to have these six recognitions when we come to the Dharma. So the first one, seeing that we're the patient, the Dharma, and the first, second, and third, and fourth, actually, we're the patient, the Buddha's the doctor, the Dharma's the medicine, and practicing is the way to get through. And I remember very clearly last year, Andy sitting here, and when we were talking about what we got out of the retreat, and he said, well, the big thing for me is I figured out that I'm the patient, you know, because it's possible to study the Dharma for quite a long time and know many different thises and thats and different categories of different things, but you don't see yourself as the patient and the Dharma as something to practice. It's something interesting. It could be entertaining. It can be fascinating, especially when you get into the different logical arguments and the different categories and this and that and the different explanations of different things. It can be very intellectually stimulating, you know. But if we don't see ourselves as the patient, then coming to Dharma class is like going to school. We're just there for the academic information. And nothing really goes into our heart and benefits us. Okay? So, but when we realize that we are sick, okay, what's our disease? It's ignorance, anger, and attachment. And when we really feel the pain of the disease, you know, the pain of being born in a body that gets old and sick and dies, the pain of having a mind that's overwhelmed by ignorance, anger, clinging attachment, arrogance, laziness, you know, when we really see our situation as something painful, like a person who's sick sees their disease as something painful, then we really take the Dharma into our heart. And so, you know, there we can see why the Buddha taught the First Noble Truth first. Why did he teach about dukkha at the very beginning? Because we have to look at what our situation is and own up to it, because unless we do that, then we don't see ourselves as a patient and we don't get any real benefit from the teachings. Okay? So we're the patient, but the Buddha is the doctor. So it's not like we're sitting there, oh, my stomach hurts from ignorance, anger, and attachment, but I'm listening to this doctor, you know, who's actually, they're not a doctor, they're just a Hollywood entertainer, you know, and what they're saying has no meaning. You know, if you don't see the Buddha as the doctor who understands, you know, our disease, then we're not going to take the teachings seriously, okay? And we're just going to sit there and whimper because we're sick. So, you know, we really have to see the Buddha as a doctor who has studied, you know, who knows these diseases and the ways to cure them inside and out, not just because he's studied them, but because he's been sick with them and he's managed to cure himself. Okay? So seeing the Buddha as the doctor and seeing the Dharma as the medicine. Okay? So again, the Dharma isn't just nice things to write down in our notebooks so that we could say, you know, we heard these Buddhist teachings, or we heard these far-out methods, or blah, blah, blah. But really seeing the Dharma as the medicine. And the same way, it's like, you know, when you're really sick, when you're really miserable and sick, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor prescribes the medicine, you go and get that medicine as soon as you leave the doctor's office, don't you? And as soon as you have, you know, you tell them don't even put it in the bag because you open the thing and pop a pill before you even get back in the car because you're so miserable that you want that medicine ASAP. Okay? Well, that's the way we need to feel about the Dharma. Okay? That the Dharma is this medicine that's going to cure us. And so here I have this teaching, here's the medicine, I need to take it. And, you know, use it in my life, and this is really precious. You know, why is it precious? Because it's going to cure me. And so that's the fourth recognition, is that, you know, is that taking the medicine is going to cure you. So it's like, you know, you don't go buy the medicine at the pharmacy, yeah, come home, leave it on the counter, yeah, Put some magazines over it, let it sit around, maybe go back next week, get another prescription, buy some more medicine, and it sits around the house too. And so pretty soon your house is just a bunch of pills, but all the bottles are unopened because you haven't taken anything, and yet your stomach still hurts. You know, that kind of person we would say is being very foolish. So it's the same way, you know, if we go and receive teachings, but we don't practice, and we're just collecting. Geshe Gnawandarvi used to tease us about, you know, you have notebooks full of teachings on a shelf in your room. But when you have a problem, do you ever practice the Dharma? Yeah? And so we have to really see that practice is the way, you know, to cure ourselves from the disease of ignorance, anger, and attachment and stop the suffering. Okay. Now, so you might remember when Khyentse Rinpoche, you know, when he taught the 12 links and he was teaching that three of them are afflictions, two of them are karma, mm-hmm. and seven of them are results. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to see, you know, okay, here I'm suffering from these results right now and I'm creating more of the afflictions and more of the karma, which are causes to have more of these results. And, you know, the Dharma is really the medicine to start practicing so that I can cut, you know, constantly creating more and more sets of the 12 links of dependent arising that produce samsara. Okay? And then fifth, we want to see the Buddha as a holy being whose Dharma medicine is non-deceptive. That's kind of clear, because if you don't respect the doctor and you don't think the medicine's any good, then, you know, you're only hurting yourself. Or even if you take the medicine and you think that the medicine's good, if you don't see the Buddha as a holy being and have some gratitude, then what kind of human being are we? You know? I mean, if we're suffering from an illness and the doctor cures us, we go back and say thank you. Or at least we should. Yeah, you know, have some appreciation for what somebody did for us. And so here it's also, you know, feeling that kind of appreciation for the Buddha and seeing him as a holy being and having that kind of reverence. Because that really makes our mind quite happy, and it really uplifts the mind. And then because of that, then we do the sixth one, which is praying that the Dharma exists long. Yeah. So because we found the Dharma valuable, we want it to exist in this world, not only so that we can benefit, but so that other people will have the opportunity to hear the teachings and to benefit. And we don't just pray that the Dharma exists long, but I think we should actively try and do something in our lives to contribute to the Dharma existing long. Okay? So instead of just taking things for granted, oh yeah, there's monasteries, there's Dharma centers, there's books, you know, after everybody else does all the hard work of getting it all set up and running, then I'll come and I'll buy the book or I'll go to the Dharma center or do something else, but don't ask me to do any work. Okay? But instead, you know, really feeling the preciousness of the Dharma, then from our heart wanting to you know, not only pray that the Dharma exists forever, but contributing our energy to it. Goenkaji, when he leads courses, he does things the way we do, in the sense that you know, everything is done on a Dana basis. Okay? He's a little bit stricter because unless you stay till the end of the course, you aren't allowed to give Dana. If you leave early, they will not accept your Dana. You have to stay till the end of the course. Okay? And all the people who are the cooks and the staff, they are all people who have done the retreats before. And it is considered an honor and a privilege to be able to serve a retreat. Yeah? And so they won't just take anybody as a volunteer. You have to have done a retreat so that you really see the value of the Dharma and you really want to make it available to other people. And because you want other people to benefit from the teachings, then you want to cook so that they can go to the retreat. And you want to clean so they can go to the retreat. And you want to work in the office so they can go to the retreat. Yeah. And so the volunteers have that kind of attitude. And it's really quite beautiful to see that, you know, because they have a very good motivation when they're serving. Like Flora, you know, she did the Vajrasattva retreat the first year, and last year she came back to cook so that other people could come to the retreat because she wanted other people to have an experience like she had. Yeah. And so this is kind of what the sixth one is, you know, we pray for the longevity of the Dharma, but we put our energy into it too. Yeah. Because we really want to make it accessible for other people. Okay, so that's that topic. Okay, now we're into the topic of qualities of a spiritual master and a disciple. Okay, so, you know, we all fancy ourselves to be great spiritual practitioners, you know, and yeah, I'm certainly a very qualified disciple and, you know, or whatever. And then also, you know, people in this country, because Buddhism is new, they don't know what qualities to look for in a spiritual mentor. And so anybody who has the title teacher, they think, you know, has gone through some kind of certification process or is a qualified teacher. But no, there's no kind of certification process. You know, your Dharma understanding, you know, you can get an educational degree, but your Dharma understanding, how do you ever certify that? You know, there's no actual way to do it. Yeah. So it's really up to the students to check the qualities of people and then decide if they want those people to be their teachers. Okay, so we're the ones who choose our own teachers. So here's what the third Dalai Lama said. However, although merely hearing the Dharma teachings with the proper attitude is an extremely dynamic experience, it is important to say something about the qualities of a Lama and teacher. In general, the qualities of the various masters of the fundamental vehicle, Mahayana and Vajrayana methods are manifold, and any Buddhist master is a worthy teacher. Yet the specific qualities required of one who gives a discourse on the jewel-like Lamrim tradition are described in ornament of Mahayana sutras. He or she should have realization, i.e., his or her mind stream should, one, be tamed with realization of the higher training in ethical conduct, two, be stilled with the realization of the higher training in concentration, three, be completely tempered with realization of the higher training in wisdom, four, have authoritative scriptural learning, i.e., heard many teachings on the three baskets of scriptures and so forth from competent masters, five, be in possession of an awareness that can perceive emptiness, six, have more learning and realization than the disciple. Okay. So let's look at these. Now, first of all, when he says here, any Buddhist master is a worthy teacher. You know, in the time of the third Dalai Lama, he was living in old Tibet, and maybe that was the case. You know, you had a very insular situation. If people did not behave properly, they could not keep their status as a teacher. Yeah, people weren't sent out to a foreign country to live on their own without any support or supervision or anything, or the force of the social pressure to keep people going. So maybe that was true in his time, but now with Buddhism spreading to different countries, you know, it's very important to really pay attention to the qualities of somebody before we take them as our teacher. And so for that reason, His Holiness advises people to go and study with somebody for a while before we actually form that student-teacher relationship. And I think that's very wise, because then we know the teacher and we know their qualities and we know what we're doing. Yeah, I've seen often that if a student forms a relationship too soon, even if the teacher is a very qualified teacher, because the student jumped into it, then their own mind wasn't very stable. Yeah? And they don't have the ability to form a good relationship, even though the teacher themselves happens to be very qualified. Yeah? So it's good to really check things out. So, and especially in the West, we tend to be very impressed with glitter. You know, I mean, we're Hollywood culture, aren't we? Yeah? So the higher the throne, and actually this is true for old Tibet also, you know, high thrones. You want a teacher that has a high throne, that wants a lot of brocade, that wears a big hat, okay, that says a lot of things in a language that you don't understand, because then they must really be holy. Okay? We want somebody who has a lot of titles, who has a lot of status, who can say, oh, I studied with so-and-so, oh, they're a big high lama, somebody who's recognized as an incarnation of so-and-so, you know. But His Holiness is always telling the Tibetans and the Westerners that, you know, these things are just superficial, and a lot of them are societal conventions, and that just because somebody has a title as a Rinpoche or as a Lama, it doesn't mean that they have Dharma realizations. Yeah. I remember many years ago, somebody did their doctoral thesis by interviewing a lot of the tulkus, Yeah, this must have been, they must have been the late 70s, early 80s, because I read the book in the early 80s. And I remember being so shocked at one of the introductory essays where His Holiness is saying that not everybody who's recognized as an incarnate lama is necessarily a bodhisattva or a Buddha. He said some people have that title because they accumulated the good karma to have that kind of social prestige. Yeah, I remember being so shocked. But, you know, what it does is, this isn't said to make us skeptical of people, but it's said so that we can really ourselves, the process of looking for a qualified teacher makes us into a qualified student. Because if we're the kind of student who just looks for the glitter, how qualified of a spiritual seeker are we? Yeah? Whereas if we're somebody who's willing to slow down and like, oh, well, what's this person's ethical conduct like? How do they relate to other people? What if they study? Do they have a good relationship with their own teacher? You know, how do they practice? If we're willing to take the time to look into real live dharma instead of superficial glitter, then that's already making ourselves a more serious dharma student, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So it's a process of maturation on our part to start knowing what to look like, to look for. So we want to, Maitreya, in Ornament of Mahayana Sutras, he set out these 10 qualities, the 6 first ones, you know, we just read. Okay, being tamed with the realization of the higher training of ethical conduct. So whatever level of vows a person has, then they should be keeping those vows. Okay, if they're a monastic, they should be celibate. And if they're a lay person, then they, you know, should be keeping the lay person's vows that they took. Okay, because the higher training in ethical conduct, that tames your mind, even though it's oriented towards the 7 non-virtues of body and speech. In order to abandon those 7, you have to work with your mind. So it's one level of calming to practice the higher training of ethical conduct. Another level of calming, you know, is to practice the higher training in concentration, to begin to suppress the manifest afflictions, so that they aren't in the mind. Okay, the higher training in ethical conduct, you know, we might still have a lot of negative thoughts, but it's not coming out verbally and physically. But with the higher training in concentration, then the negative thoughts have been temporarily suppressed. They haven't been abandoned, but by the power of one's concentration, then those thoughts aren't in the mind running the show. And then the third is to be completely tempered with realization of the higher training in wisdom. So it's the higher training in wisdom that actually cuts the afflictions from the root so that they can no longer arise in the mind. Okay? So we're looking at the highest qualities, you know, highest quality teacher that, you know, to find. Somebody with those 3 higher trainings. In addition, they have authoritative scriptural learning. So they've heard many teachings on the 3 baskets of scripture and so forth from competent masters. Okay? So it's somebody who's studied a lot. They're not just making up their own dharma. They're not just teaching one text or one practice because that's the only one they know. But they have a wide breadth and depth of understanding of the dharma, because this gives them the ability then to teach other sentient beings according to what those sentient beings need, and to explain the dharma from a diversity of viewpoints, and to bring in lots of different teachings that can help somebody. Where if somebody has not studied much, then they don't know how to explain things, so they can't direct you to where you can learn more about topics that might be of, you know, of great importance to you. So they've heard teachings on the three baskets. Okay, so that's the Vinaya, the Sutra, and the Abhidharma baskets. The Vinaya is associated with the higher training in ethical conduct. The Sutra basket is associated with the higher training in concentration. And the Abhidharma is associated with the higher training in wisdom. And they've studied this from competent masters. So the person that you're studying from, you know, they didn't just receive a teaching, you know, because they woke up one morning with a thunderbolt, or they read it in a magazine, or, you know, and had a great profound realization, or, you know, because of one thing or another. But they really have transmissions from competent teachers, you know. And I would add to that that they have good relationships with their own teachers. They haven't just kind of learned something and then said, oh, and then turned around and criticized their teachers and thrown their teachers out like a piece of, you know, like a dog throwing out old meat. Okay, they often talk like that, that, you know, we should not treat our teachers as, it was what you were talking about earlier, you know, of knowing somebody and we sponge everything out and we just throw them away afterwards. Yeah. So, not having that kind of attitude. Okay. So our teachers should be in possession of an awareness that can perceive emptiness, because clearly if they can, then they're in better qualified to lead us on that same path. And they should have more learning and realizations than the disciple. So, you know, sometimes we may want teaching on a particular topic, and some teacher, maybe they don't have wide knowledge, but they have a lot of breadth in a particular topic, or they've received a transmission of a particular topic that's important for us. You know, so in whatever we're studying from somebody, we want to make sure that they have more knowledge, you know, than we do in that. Okay? So the third Dalai Lama says, these are the six necessary qualifications of a Lamrim teacher. As well, he or she should have four altruistic attitudes. So these four make up the ten that are the common list. So one, skill and spontaneous creativity in applying the methods to generate progress within the disciples whom he or she teaches out of a pure motivation free from grasping for wealth, fame, or power. Two, enthusiasm and joy in giving time and energy to teaching. Three, diligence and perseverance in teaching. Four, beyond losing patience with the disciples who practice poorly. Okay, so these are very important qualities for a teacher to have, okay? So they need to be skillful and creative in being able to teach us. Okay, to be able to give us the right teaching at the right time. So this doesn't mean necessarily the right teaching in a formal setting, you know, teaching setting like this, but it could also mean the right teaching in the day-to-day life, pointing out to you something that you need to hear at that particular time. Okay, so they need to be skillful like that. And then they need to be able to teach the students out of a pure motivation, free from grasping at wealth, fame, or power. Now that's actually very difficult, okay? Because, you know, you could be teaching somebody, and then you think, you know, I'm putting all this energy into teaching. This person doesn't even, you know, treat me very nice as a result of it, you know. But they don't give any offerings, or they don't say thank you, or they don't ask if they can do something for me. And here I am teaching so hard, and they treat me, you know, like this lump of old meat, but, you know, the dog. So, you know, it's very easy to get into that frame of mind. Or it could be that somebody, you know, has a lot of attachment to wealth, and they want to collect a whole, you know, range of disciples Because then all those disciples get the money, and then they can have a nice situation and, you know, live well. They can also have, you can have, you know, there's a lot of status from having a lot of students. Yeah? You know, you walk in and all your students are there, you know, bowing down to you, and you know they're all talking to their friends about how wonderful you are, and when you go somewhere they're all trotting behind you obediently. And so it can be very easy sometimes to get a little twinge of arrogance there. Little twinge, a big thing. Or power. You know, somebody who wants power over other people. Oh, all these students are so dedicated to me. I must be really wonderful. I can tell them to do this, and they'll absolutely do it. And this feeling of, oh, I have power over these other people. Okay? Yeah. So you just try being a teacher to the two kitties, and you see you don't have power over anybody. Power over you. Okay? So you want somebody who's really teaching out of a good motivation, who's not having thoughts of the eight worldly dharma. And then second, somebody who has enthusiasm and joy in giving time and energy to the teachings. So they like teaching, they like helping you, you know, when you're full of doubts and questions, they don't say, go away and call me in 3 months, you know? But they want to help you figure your way out of it, and they like teaching. They're not saying, oh, you know, I taught you 2 weeks ago, go away, come back another 3 weeks and I'll give you another 15 minutes. But it's somebody who really, you know, enjoys teaching. Okay, then three, they're diligent and perseverant in teaching. So they try to teach you a whole subject, or they try to give you the whole transmission. You know, they just kind of don't teach a little bit and then get bored and, you know, say that's enough. And then fourth, and this one's really important, they're beyond losing patience with disciples who practice poorly. Okay, this one's really important, you know. And I'm seeing this very clearly in this transcribing I'm doing of the interviews that I've had with my teacher. Mm-hmm. And sometimes how I just seem like what I'm saying, I'm just such a total idiot. And yet my teacher just, you know, happily just keeps on answering the questions and doing the things. And the translator, I think he was giving me a hint one day, he said, well, I just watch it. You know, he's so compassionate, because if somebody, you know, kept asking me questions that I've already answered or asking me things that I've already explained, I would just get really impatient. You're giving me a hint? Yeah. But, you know, having a good teacher like this. So that's a thing of, you know, maybe I'm a slow student. But then sometimes, I mean, you really need to have teachers. When we practice poorly, when our teachers give us some instructions and we do the opposite, yeah? When they say, when we come and ask for advice and they say, meditate on this, and we don't meditate on that, and we do something else, and, you know, or they say, you know, be really careful with your anger, and then we go out and we splash our anger out over everybody, or, you know, we criticize our teacher, or we pick faults at them, or we request a teaching and then we don't show up for the teaching that we requested. You know, we do all sorts of really horrible behavior, you know. Or we think that our teacher should, you know, adjust their schedule to make time to see us, and, you know, we shouldn't have to adjust our schedule to go and see them. So we really need, you know, to have teachers that have an incredible amount of patience to put up with us sometimes. Okay. So he says, if you can find a guru possessing these six personal and four altruistic qualities, request him or her for teachings and then follow them well. If you find a teacher like that, request teachings and then don't just sit there and listen, but follow the teachings, you know. So I think it's important, you know, now in this life to do that, and then to make, you know, very important prayers to meet fully qualified teachers in future life, and not just meet them, but to have the sense to request them to teaching, for teachings, and not just to have the teachings, but have for us to have the sense to follow the teachings well once we do receive them. Now, finding a teacher with all 10 qualities is difficult. Yeah. So they say if you can't find a teacher with all 10 qualities, then find a teacher with as many qualities, as many of the 10 as you possibly can. Okay. And if you still can't do that, then at least find a teacher who considers future lives more important than this life. Okay, and somebody who considers, you know, others' happiness more important than their own. No, and somebody who is doubting the perception of inherent existence. So at least have a teacher like that, okay? Because if your teacher considers this life more important than future ones, then they're not going to be a very ethical person. If they consider their own happiness more important than others, then they're not going to have the endurance to teach us, you know. If they don't doubt the vision of inherent existence that we perceive, then they're not going to be able to get us to question it or to teach us the path of wisdom. Okay? So it may take us some time, you know, to get to know somebody and to see if they have these qualities. The time to check out somebody to see if they have these qualities is before we make the relationship with them as our teacher. After we accept somebody as our teacher, that is not the time to go back and analyze whether they have these qualities or not. Yeah? Okay, it's like, if I can use a very gross and inappropriate example, you read Consumer Report before you buy the washing machine. Okay, you don't buy the washing machine and then read Consumer Report afterwards. Okay, so you do your research beforehand, and that's the time to ask the questions. After we take somebody as our teacher, that's the time to then appreciate their good qualities and listen to the Dharma that they teach us and put that Dharma into practice and have a sense of respect and appreciation for what they do. Okay. Dedicate?
Can I say something really quick?
Sure.
You know, whenever I hear this one, I always feel so very, very, very bad. I'm so sorry that I wasn't. Man, it's a real long story, but Venerable Tudun is really a patient teacher.
but the remarkable thing is, you know, when you had difficulties, is you didn't give up. You went back and you used the Dharma and you owned your own mistakes and you worked through it. And you learned a lot and grew a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something quite admirable.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Meanwhile, Monty's still complaining.
He's not very good yet.
All these years, and they still don't feed me. Okay.